From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dr. Chris Yanu is a war surgeon. He estimates that hundreds of the thousands of people he's treated around the world have been landmine victims. On today's Fresh Air, he tells us why he's helping lead the International Committee of the Red Cross's campaign to ban anti-personnel mines. These mines remain in place long after a war has ended and continue to maim and kill civilians. The U.S. State Department recognizes the landmine problem but doesn't support a ban. Assistant Secretary of State Thomas McNamara will tell us why. Also today, Milo Miles reviews They Walk Among Us, a new best-of release by Mudboy and the Neutrons. And we'll hear my current favorite record about being snowed in, which is what we are on the East Coast. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Major airports in New York City and Washington are closed until tomorrow, and snow continues to fall in some parts of the Northeast, which has been hit by one of the worst blizzards in the region this century. At least 23 deaths have been attributed to the storm, which has shut down businesses, local governments, federal offices, and school systems. Some major highways have been closed as well, including the 8-lane New Jersey Turnpike, because plows have not been able to keep up with blowing and drifting snow. Coastal areas are bracing for flooding from storm tides. New York Governor George Pataki says his state is taking precautions.
Primarily, we're concerned that any time from 9 to 12, we have very serious risk of erosion and flooding on the north shore of Long Island, along Westchester and the East River. The wind is blowing the storm in the sound, and it creates a tremendous risk. So we're providing pumps to local governments, and we're prepared to assist with evacuations if that becomes necessary.
New York Governor George Pataki. The storm also dumps snow, sleet, and freezing rain on the southeastern states, which aren't used to dealing with major winter storms. Adam Hochberg reports.
Now that the precipitation has stopped, crews have made some progress at reopening major highways across the Carolinas, Virginia, and Kentucky. But there's a lot more work to be done. Some parts of the North Carolina mountains received more than 2 feet of snow. Much of the rest of the region was hit by a snow and sleet combination that stranded motorists, closed airports, and pulled down power lines. More than 10 deaths are being blamed on the weather across the South. Most were victims of car accidents. A North Carolina highway worker died from a heart attack while trying to move a fallen tree off of a road, while in the Charlotte area, a 12-year-old boy is hospitalized in critical condition after his sled was hit by a truck. And in Wilkesboro, North Carolina, more than 17,000 chickens died when the roof of their chicken house collapsed under the weight of the snow. I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Budget negotiations between President Clinton and GOP congressional leaders have resumed at the White House. The Republicans reportedly brought a new proposal with them that includes $63 billion less in Medicare and Medicaid savings than were included in their original budget balancing plan. A cargo plane slid off a runway and into a crowded marketplace in Kinshasa, Zaire today, killing over 250 people. The plane, which was owned by a Zairean firm, was in flames when it came to a stop. Four Russian crew members survived the crash and were taken to a city clinic, but they were nearly lynched by an angry crowd that gathered there. They were taken into protective custody by police. A jury has begun deliberating the fate of a homeless man charged with stalking entertainer Madonna. Jurors heard 4 days of testimony against Robert Hoskins. The witnesses included the singer herself, who said Hoskins vowed to marry her or kill her. On Wall Street, after a storm-shortened day of trading, stock prices ended higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 16.25 points. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary William Perry says the U.S. is willing to send troops to the Golan Heights to bolster any peace agreement if both Israel and Syria ask for help. Perry was speaking to reporters after a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres in Jerusalem. Peres welcomed the offer, saying the troops could serve as a symbolic deterrent, but he said he's not asking for a fighting force to defend Israel. Syria wants Israel to return the entire Golan Heights as part of any peace agreement. The Chinese government today took foreign journalists on a tour of a prominent Shanghai orphanage, which has been accused of having deliberately starved hundreds of children to death in the 1980s and early 90s. Orphanage officials denied the charges made by the New York-based group Human Rights Watch, but they dodged questions about specific allegations made in the report. NPR's Mary Kay Magstad reports from Hong Kong.
Journalists who visited the Shanghai orphanage today described it as well-equipped, well-heated, and colorfully decorated. To Human Rights Watch, this isn't a surprise. Its report acknowledges that the facility has improved over the past 2 years. But before that, the report says, the orphanage had a policy of deliberately starving some children to death to make way for others. It also accused former director Han Wei-chung of having sexually abused or raped several girl orphans. Han Wei-chung lashed out at the main source of the report, a doctor who had worked at the orphanage for 7 years. He called her crazy and said she was making it all up because she wanted his job. But the report included extensive documentation and photos backing up the doctor's claims. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Hong Kong.
The Supreme Court has rejected an appeal by a Pennsylvania prison guard who may lose his job because he objects to wearing an American flag patch on his uniform. Dieter Trost is a 20-year military veteran, but he believes that being ordered to wear the flag desecrates and debases it. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the greatest threats to American troops in Bosnia is landmines. UN officials have estimated that between 3 and 6 million landmines were set during the war there. Landmines kill long after wars have ended. Bosnia is just one example of the problem. The State Department estimates that there are between 85 and 110 million uncleared landmines in 64 countries around the world. The International Committee of the Red Cross is at the forefront of a campaign to ban anti-personnel mines, landmines that are triggered by the weight of a footstep. My guest, Chris Yanu, is medical director for the Red Cross's campaign against anti-personnel mines. He's a war surgeon who has worked in Cambodia, Lebanon, Burundi, Afghanistan, and Somalia. He's joined us before to talk about his work. Dr. Yanu has treated hundreds of landmine victims. I asked him to describe the typical injuries caused by anti-personnel mines.
There are two particular types of anti-personnel mines. The one is called a blast mine, and this is the sort of mine that is detonated when somebody steps on it. So there's a pressure sort of triggering mechanism, and you get an explosion. Now, the explosion causes a very rapid expansion of air through heat, and this will tear off somebody's leg. It creates what is called a traumatic amputation. Depending on the size of the explosive charge and whether the victim is a child or an adult, you may have the foot, the leg below the knee, the leg above the knee, simply blown away. Secondarily, you will have fragments, either from the casing of the mine, gravel, grass, soil, from the surrounding earth that is pushed up into the stump of what is left of the leg, or into the opposite leg, into the buttocks, the genitalia. I even operated on one fellow once who had a wound in the chest wall, in the muscles of the chest. And as I was cutting this out, I found pieces from the bones of his foot. So the foot that was pulverized by the explosion created secondary fragments, which were the bones of the foot, and these injured the victim in the muscles of the chest wall. The second type of anti-personnel mine is a fragmentation device, and this could be similar to a what looks like a hand grenade. It gives off small pieces of metal fragments, and they can be either directional and therefore cover a certain arc, or they can spread out over 360 degrees in a circle. And the injury there resembles very much what one would see with any sort of injury resulting from a mortar shell or a hand grenade. The body is peppered with multiple fragments of metal. Depending on the distance of the victim from the mine at the time of explosion, those fragments will either tear the body to shreds, penetrate more or less profoundly, injure or kill. The blast type of mine usually does not kill. There's usually not enough explosive substance in the mine to kill. It's almost purposely made to maim and not to kill.
Where did you treat the most landmine injuries during your career?
Well, I've worked both in Cambodia and in Afghanistan, and as well as in Somalia twice. Cambodia and Afghanistan are probably two of the countries in the world that have been most infested with anti-personnel mines. I spent about 8-9 months in both countries, 1991 in Cambodia, 1993 in Afghanistan. And we had hundreds of patients over the months that I was there that were maimed, wounded by anti-personnel mines.
Are injuries from anti-personnel mines particularly hard to treat?
They're very difficult to treat. They're particularly horrific, especially the blast mines. You not only have this traumatic amputation, a limb being literally torn away, you have a great deal of soiling. The blast, as I said, picks up gravel and grass and soil and so forth and pushes it up between the layers of the muscles. It's particularly difficult for the inexperienced surgeon to operate, in that the level of injury is actually much greater than what meets the naked eye to begin with. And you have to understand the pathological mechanism so that when you operate, you're transforming this dirty, contaminated, traumatic amputation into a clean surgical amputation. You have to cut far enough up, while at the same time trying to preserve as much as possible of the still healthy tissues. And if you don't know to look between the muscles in what is called the tissue planes, then you may very well miss it. If you do, then you're going to leave contaminated, very often contaminated organic material behind. And that is a recipe for gas gangrene or tetanus. So it can be very difficult. They're particularly horrific wounds. I have colleagues who have told me that when they're called in for an emergency case, they almost pray that it be a bullet injury or a fragment, a shell wound, not a mine injury. To see almost every mine injury that comes in, a blast mine injury, where the patient is disfigured. They're missing a foot, a leg, if somebody has picked it up, or the deminers, the people who try to do mine clearance. And sometimes they're not professional. They're peasants who have to grow food to feed their families. And therefore they'll go out into their rice paddies or their fields, and they will try to clear out the mines themselves. And they will lose a hand, both hands, be injured in the face, lose their vision. These are wounds that cause unnecessary suffering, superfluous injury, and very, very horrific disfiguring injuries.
Do you often find that by the time somebody gets to the hospital, their wound is already infected?
Very often. In many of these countries, and here it depends on many factors of geography and so forth, all war wounds are, by definition, dirty and contaminated. Now, if the patient takes 3 days, a couple of weeks to finally reach a hospital, that was very, very often the case in a country like Somalia. In Afghanistan also, with mountains and difficulty in transportation, you will often receive patients after 3 or 4 days time of injury. Cambodia was a bit better. The average transportation time was between 6 to 12 hours. But people will arrive with not only contaminated wood, but established infection. And we know also from our database that mine-injured patients undergo multiple operations. On the average, in war surgery, somebody was hit with a bullet. On the average, you're going to have 2 operations per patient. With mine injuries, the average is 3 to 4 operations. And if it's a mine-induced amputation, you get 4, 5, even 6 amputations or operations, because you have to keep cutting out the infected material, the devitalized material. We know that with blood transfusions as well, people who are injured with mines need 3 to 4 times as much blood.
Would you say that most of the victims of landmines that you've treated were intended victims, even if they were civilians? Is this part of the civilian population that was targeted by the people who laid the mines?
The anti-personnel mines have been used in very indiscriminate ways. So that very often what obviously was intended was waging war against, yes, the civilian population. But even if you do not use the mine in an indiscriminate way, The mine, by its very nature, is an indiscriminate weapon. Just think of it. The only weapon system that exists, where it is the victim that detonates the weapon, is a mine. There is no soldier squeezing a trigger, pushing a button. The mine is put out in the fields, in the mountains, on the riverbanks. It is the victim, and whether that victim is military, civilian, a woman, a child, a peasant, the mine by its very nature is indiscriminate. Whether there is an ongoing conflict, a ceasefire. In Central America, you have countries that knew 10 years of war in the 1980s. There is now a peace process, democratic elections, and yet there are still people falling victim to anti-personnel mines. In North Africa, in Egypt, you have mines left over from the Second World War, Rommel and the Afrika Korps and Field Marshal Montgomery. And 50 years later, you have victims to landmines. And therefore, the whole problem with anti-personnel mines is that already they cannot be targeted, since it is the victim who is going to set it off. And as a result, this is one of the major reasons that the mere existence and the use of anti-personnel mines goes contrary to some very basic fundamental principles of international humanitarian law.
Now, you worked for a while in Cambodia, which has an enormous number of landmines, though I couldn't tell you exactly how many.
they estimated it between 8 to 10 million.
Wow. So did you have to be very careful all the time where you walked, or did you know where the minefields were?
Well, the areas where we could go were very circumscribed. I was there in 1991, even before the ceasefire. Since then, you had a United Nations mission and elections and so forth. But I was there before the ceasefire, and we were very, very close to the front lines, only a question of about 15, 20 miles. So even the areas where we could go at the time were very circumscribed. And then we were always told, as a matter of security, I mean, we usually rode bicycles around the village where we were working. Nonetheless, we were not allowed to go off into the fields. Small plastic water-resistant mines will be carried downstream of a river. And so even if the people tell you this area is safe, they go there every day to water their livestock, or they go to fetch water or to do their laundry or what have you, the next day a mine could float downstream. And I remember well in Somalia, in 1992, in the city of Beletwane, where I was working at one point, in the middle of the town, a girl would go every day to the river to fetch water for her home. And she would go to the same spot. And one day she went down and she stepped on a mine. Now, Beletwane is about 40 kilometers from the Ethiopian border. There had been a war between Ethiopia and Somalia back in 77, 78. It rains in the mountains in Ethiopia. And here was a small plastic water-resistant mine that was washed down the mountain slope into the riverbed, downstream, and landed on the banks of this town where this young girl would go down every day to the same spot, she thought in perfect safety, until one day there was a landmine waiting there for her.
Did you treat her?
I operated on her. I had to amputate her, yes.
What was the outcome?
She had an amputation below the knee. She survived the amputation, but it's not the easiest sort of thing to have to live with in a country like Somalia, which at the time was facing a horrendous famine as well.
My guest is Dr. Chris Yanu. He's a war surgeon who is now serving as the medical director of the International Committee of the Red Cross's campaign to ban anti-personnel landmines. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is war surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu. The International Committee of the Red Cross has been keeping a data bank of the injuries that it treats at its war hospitals around the world. What have you learned from those data banks about anti-personnel mine injuries?
As I mentioned before, the extraordinary amount of work, the extra number of operations, the extra amount of blood that is needed for anti-personnel mine injuries. Let me give you an example. To treat 100 patients injured by assault rifles, bullet wounds, you need an average of 50 units of blood. Now, some cases are going to use several units. Many cases will not need any blood. But the average for treating 100 patients is 50 units of blood. To treat 100 mine-injured patients, you need 120 units, more than twice as much. To treat 100 people amputated because of landmines, you need 350 units. That's seven times as much blood. In many countries of the Third World, providing that blood in a safe and secure fashion is difficult because of the presence of various transmissible diseases, HIV, syphilis, malaria, hepatitis. All of that increases, obviously, the amount of work that is done. Hospitalization time. Most patients with a fragment wound or a bullet wound will leave the hospital after 14 or 15 days. A landmine victim, the average hospital stay is 25 days. And for a landmine amputee, it's 35 days. These are the sort of things that one sees and from analyzing our database. And it reinforces, of course, our own personal experience. I've had to operate on hundreds of landmine injured amongst thousands of patients. And for all of the statistical data that my analysis of our database gives me, I have numerous personal anecdotes of cases that I've had to treat that symbolize and signify the human reality of the suffering of these weapons.
What is the International Committee of the Red Cross calling for?
The International Red Cross has started a campaign. We are not alone. There is an international coalition of over 350 non-governmental organizations. The Secretary General of the United Nations, the head of the UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, Madame Ogata, the Pope, Desmond Tutu, and the Dalai Lama, Elie Wiesel, a whole series of Nobel Peace Prize winners, and the International Committee of the Red Cross. We are calling for the total ban on the production, transfer, and use of anti-personnel mines. There is an international convention, a United Nations convention of 1980, that is supposed to try to limit and regulate the use of certain classical weapons. And last September, October, there was a review conference of this international convention. It came to a stalemate. People could not agree on what sort of rules and limitations to impose on the use of anti-personnel mines. We tend to see this as a step forward, as progress. 3 or 4 years ago, there was consensus, basically not to do anything about controlling landmines. Now there are more and more countries that, following the Red Cross, the non-governmental organization Coalition, and other major world figures, who have called for an end to the scourge, the human suffering being produced by the widespread use of these very indiscriminate weapons.
I'm sure you oppose war as well as landmines, and wars will likely continue anyways.
Well, we are not utopians. We are very, very, very pragmatic people. We are not calling for a ban to war. The point is that the International Committee of the Red Cross is based on the premise that there are something called the laws of war. In 1868, some military experts to the Tsar of Russia, Tsar Nicholas, came to him and said, "We have a new discovery. It is called an exploding bullet, a dum-dum bullet." And the Tsar was so appalled by the prospect of military assault rifles shooting bullets that would explode within the human body that he called in his cousins and relatives, who were basically the kings and queens of Europe at the time, and they came out with the St. Petersburg Declaration, which banned the use, the military use, of exploding bullets. And ever since, every country that produces ammunition for military assault rifles produces fully jacketed bullets, which do not explode. They are not dum-dum. In 1925, after the First World War, the international community agreed to ban the use of chemical weapons. The international community has agreed to ban the use of biological weapons. This is part of the laws of war, the Geneva Conventions, which tell the military, you may shoot at the military, but not at civilians. If you take prisoners of war, you're not supposed to torture them, you're not supposed to rape them, you're not supposed to commit summary executions. Now, there are, of course, a great deal of problems in having people respect the laws of war. But nonetheless, the attempt is there. Certain rules of war have been respected. And what we are trying to do is simply say, in the same fashion that the human consciousness has stigmatized chemical weapons, biological weapons, and that they are no longer used by civilized society, anti-personnel mines should also be banned, should also be stigmatized. We should feel the same revulsion and the same horror that we feel when we hear about the idea of infecting someone as a method of warfare.
You know, I think part of the reason why for a lot of people landmines don't cause that same sense of horror is because they seem so low-tech by comparison. We're used to being particularly appalled by high-tech weapons, biological weapons,
there is
nuclear
nothing
bomb.
But there's nothing high-tech about a biological weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Making a culture of bacteria, which you can do in your kitchen. Chemical weapons, what is so high-tech about mustard gas? Chlorine gas. There's no way to control the production. How we control the weapons, however, is through the stigmatization of the use. Now, I think the problem with anti-personnel weapons and why we do not yet have that same stigmatization is because we have been told all too often that there is a legitimate military use. And I would beg to differ. I'm not a military man, but I've spent most of the last 15 years in war zones. I've seen a good deal more war than most of the military around the world today. I have yet to see anti-personnel mines successfully used, that is to say, to accomplish militarily what they were supposed to do.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Chris Yanu is a war surgeon who's now serving as the medical director of the International Committee of the Red Cross's campaign to ban anti-personnel landmines. In the second half of our show, we'll hear from Thomas McNamara of the U.S. State Department. You may also be interested in a documentary on landmines that will be shown Tuesday night on the public television series Nova. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on anti-personnel landmines. We talk with Assistant Secretary of State Thomas McNamara about why the U.S. still uses anti-personnel landmines and what measures it supports to control the use of them. Also, Milo Miles reviews the new Best Of album by Mudboy and the Neutrons, and we dedicate a song to all of us who are snowbound on the East Coast. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the first half of our show, Dr. Chris Yanu, a war surgeon, explained how his experiences in the field led him to support an international ban on anti-personnel landmines. The State Department does not support such a ban. We invited Thomas McNamara to explain why. He's Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs and is former ambassador at large for counterterrorism. His focus has been on arms control and regional security. The International Treaty Regulating Landmines is 15 years old. In the interim, the landmine problem has gotten so bad that now nearly 800 civilians are maimed or killed each month. The UN sponsored an international conference in October to consider strengthening restrictions on the use of landmines, but the conference fell apart without agreement. World experts will gather to continue discussions next week. I asked Assistant Secretary of State McNamara to explain the U.S. position on anti-personnel mines.
The United States has been a leader in those seeking to stop the irresponsible and indiscriminate use of anti-personnel landmines, which has become a world crisis over the past 15 years. Indeed, it has taken a horrible toll in innocent civilian lives, casualties, families destroyed, and people maimed by this indiscriminate and irresponsible use of landmines. The U.S. position has been that we need to bring this crisis to an end in a very short time because of the great amount of destruction that's being caused by these landmines. And bringing this crisis to an end is a high priority of the government. The question being debated is how best to bring the crisis to an end and how to, over the course of time, eliminate anti-personnel landmines. The question revolves basically, I think, around two questions or two issues. One is whether or not there are any legitimate uses for anti-personnel landmines, and the second is what is the best way to stop the indiscriminate and irresponsible use. So
the U.S. is opposed to, right now, banning the use of anti-personnel mines.
Yes, it's been our experience around the world that there are very few, very, very few governments that are in favor of an outright and total ban of landmines. And, in fact, none for a total ban of landmines, and very, very few in favor of a complete ban on anti-personnel landmines.
The United States says that it uses anti-personnel mines responsibly. What does responsibly mean?
Well, before I answer that, let me note that the landmine problem has come about in the last 10, 15 and more years because of some dramatic changes in technology and use of landmines. And it's in understanding the changes of technology and use that one can understand why one can use landmines in a discriminating and responsible way. First of all, the technology. Before about 1975, 1980, most landmines lasted only a very short time. Particularly in non-desert areas, they corroded. The high explosives that were in the landmines were unstable and therefore degraded relatively rapidly. Now, with new plastics, you get very little, if any, corrosion of the landmine container, and with highly stable explosives, you have an explosive device which will last, in many cases, for decades, and in some cases even longer. Hence, the new technology means that the landmines remain a major danger to civilian populations long after the wars have ended. The second problem we have is the outgrowth and the rapid increase in the number of civil wars and civil disturbances. Since it has been primarily in civil wars and civil disorders that these landmines have been indiscriminately used by guerrilla forces, by bands of bandits and ideologues, and by governments trying to defend themselves, defend their governments. The result has been that these landmines have become very low cost and very highly valued as territory denial weapons. And the low cost, the new technology, and the outgrowth of these civil wars means that we have, in the last 15 years or so, had this, and pardon the pun, this explosion in irresponsible and indiscriminate use of landmines. The United States government has not been primarily responsible for this problem, but we are doing our best to bring landmines back to the traditional use of landmines, and also by using other technologies to make sure that the landmines do not last for indefinite periods after the conflict, after the battlefield has ceased to be a battlefield.
When you say the traditional use of landmines, you mean against armies as opposed to against civilians?
Correct. Against armies and for tactical battlefield situations.
Now, what does it mean to responsibly use anti-personnel mines? What?
To responsibly, in the current, in the modern era, mm-hmm. to responsibly use landmines means to use landmines that are short-lived, mm-hmm. Unless they are in minefields that are marked and demarcated and mapped out. And that these landmines should self-destruct and self-deactivate after limited periods of time. That the landmines, instead of being all plastic so they can't be detected by metal detectors, that they have a minimum metal content so that that metal can be detected when the time comes to clear a minefield. That the landmines be put out in a fashion that does not distribute them haphazardly throughout the countryside. The final elements that we'd like to see is that there be a ban on the use of mines which are not, that is to say, mines outside of marked and monitored minefields, a ban on mines which are not self-destructing and self-deactivating, and one that requires that all remotely delivered mines, that is to say mines that are dropped by airplanes or artillery, be self-destructing and self-deactivating also. So those are some of the things that are involved in discriminate and responsible use on the battlefield by a battlefield commander of limited numbers of mines.
I know that advocates of an anti-personnel landmine ban don't really trust the self-destructing mines to all self-destruct. And if some of them malfunction and don't self-destruct, well, then you have to treat all of them as if any one of them is liable to blow up. And so what the critics say is that it might not really solve the problem.
Well, if you consider the crisis is the result of hundreds, somewhere between 80 and 100 million very cheap and inexpensive landmines being buried in the ground in about 60 different countries, landmines which cost about $3 a piece in some cases. Other cases, they're a little bit more expensive. You have a situation where you have a massive production capability with such cheap prices that it becomes the weapon of choice. If by these control mechanisms we can cut down the numbers of mines that would be produced, because the producers would be forced to expend much more money in producing the mine, you would have fewer mines produced. You would also have less demand for the mines, because clearly if you have a $30 mine, you're not going to be able to buy as many as if there are $3 mines on the market. And by banning the $3 mines and forcing production of only the more expensive mines, you can reduce the number of mines. We're also in favor of control programs that would limit exports to countries that will observe responsible use of landmines, and that countries that would not and that don't join the International Convention on Landmines would not be eligible to receive landmines. In other words, exporting countries could not send them indiscriminately around the world to just any old guerrilla band that's looking for a cheap weapon.
Now, the United States has signed a temporary ban on exports of landmines, yes?
That's correct. The U.S. government, as I said, is in a leadership role in trying to bring this problem under control, and we have a multi-track strategy that we've been following for some years now. First of all, in order to stop the problem presented by the mines already sowed in the ground in these countries. We have an extensive demining program. We are also devoting quite a few resources to research and development of new demining technologies and techniques, which will make it cheaper and safer and easier to get those mines out of the ground. That's one aspect. The second aspect is to support and have in place here in the U.S. a moratorium on the export of anti-personnel landmines. This is a moratorium that was sponsored by Senator Leahy and which the United States government has been supportive of. It's a temporary measure to put a break, an immediate break, on the export so that the problem doesn't become even worse while we're working on a long-term solution.
Has the United States military used anti-personnel landmines in any recent conflicts, such as during the Gulf War?
They were, for the most part, we haven't used them. We were going to use them in the Gulf War if it had become necessary, but it was not necessary, and we would have and could have used them in other conflicts. We do use them in places such as the demilitarized zone in Korea, where they are in active use by U.S. forces right now.
My guest is Assistant Secretary of State Thomas McNamara. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the use and regulation of anti-personnel landmines. My guest is Assistant Secretary of State Thomas McNamara. The United States is involved in the international effort to clean up the anti-personnel mines scattered around the world. What does it take to deactivate or to find the mines?
Well, I spoke earlier of the advances in mine manufacture technologies that have created this problem. I'd now like to talk a bit about the lack of advances in demining technologies, and it is in fact the discrepancy between these two situations that has been a contributing factor to the current landmine crisis. The fact is that although the landmines of the 1980s and 90s are vastly different from the landmines of World War II, and therefore much more dangerous, much more long-lasting, the technologies for extracting those mines once they're placed in the ground is approximately the same as it was during World War II. In fact, we have not developed the new technologies that would make elimination of landmines that have been placed in the ground cheaper, safer, and faster. So what it takes to get a mine out of the ground is anywhere from $150 to $1,000 per landmine. It takes many, many months to map out and to one by one take these mines out of mined areas. To demine a country such as Cambodia may well take several decades. Mm-hmm. For Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, where demining hasn't even begun yet, it takes even longer. There is at least, by most estimates, one landmine in Cambodia for every Cambodian citizen, possibly more than that. And to get them out of rice paddies and fields and jungles and roadways and paths, walk paths between villages, is an extraordinarily difficult and a very dangerous enterprise. There have been many people killed in the process of bringing humanitarian assistance to refugees. There are many of the deminers themselves who have been killed in trying to get the mines out of the ground. That's one of the reasons why we are taking substantial resources and devoting it to new technologies and new techniques to see if we can't make the demining process go faster, safer, and more surely.
Advocates of a ban on anti-personnel mines say that the human costs far outweigh any military advantages. What do you say to that?
I think that is true in all cases, and in many of the cases that we're most concerned about, where that use is irresponsible and indiscriminate. The fact is that a total ban on landmines, and even a total ban on just anti-personnel landmines, is something that would take many, many years to negotiate and many more years to get countries to ratify. There is a very strong opposition out there to a total ban. Interestingly enough, some of the strongest opposition comes from some of the larger exporters and some of the larger users, countries such as Russia and China, with long long borders, land borders, and countries which are in unstable situations vis-a-vis their neighbors, particularly those smaller countries faced by much larger neighbors, are adamantly opposed to a total ban. Some countries in the Third World oppose a ban because they believe a ban on particularly anti-personnel landmines is merely the rich country's attempt to take away a weapon that has been used in the Third World. And so they look upon it as a kind of a rich man trying to keep the poor man from getting his hands on a weapon. So for a variety of reasons, in practical terms, a ban, a total ban on anti-personnel landmines is many years in the future. And although the United States very much favors eventual elimination of landmines, we think that we cannot afford, given the world crisis that we're facing in terms of landmine propagation and landmine use, we cannot afford to wait that long in order to get a handle on this crisis and get the crisis, bring it under control, and stop the slaughter. We believe that the multi-track strategy that I've just laid out is the most practical and the best strategy to bring about an end to the world crisis.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, you're very welcome.
Thomas McNamara is Assistant Secretary of State for Political Affairs. The PBS series Nova will feature a documentary on landmines Tuesday night. This is Fresh Air. Music commentator Milo Miles is going to tell us about Mud Boy and the Neutrons, a group he says needs no introduction except to say that they're down-to-earth types, have nothing to do with particle physics, and they explain a lot about why rock and roll began in the South.
Almost every town has a band that's sort of like Mud Boy and the Neutrons. These are side project groups put together to have some fun and raise some hell. Members may be associated with the music industry, even include a couple of semi-famous folks and their eager but unfamous friends. They play local or regional gigs from time to time, develop a loyal following. They do mostly cover tunes. If they get lucky, they might even record an album. Then you hear good things about them and get the record, and it stinks. Flailing and self-indulgent, and you really had to be there at the show. But Mud Boy and the Neutrons are the glorious exception that proves the rule. And their best of, called They Walk Among Us, is a hoot, a gas, an utter panic and delight. The prime suspects in Mud Boy and the Neutrons are all Memphis miscreants, like producer and musician Jim Dickinson, singer Sid Salvage, guitarist Lee Baker, and Jimmy Crosswaite, who makes his daily bread as a puppeteer. Sure, They Walk Among Us is a noisy gonzo record, but it proves that simply playing rough and loose does not make for rock and roll attitude. You have to do just the right rough and loose. The 12 tracks on They Walk Among Us are all covers, and the only one that could conceivably be called obscure is Money Talks by Sir McRice. Most are blatant warhorses like Chuck Berry's Little Queenie and the soul standard Dark End of the Street. The trick is that these versions are the product of a lifetime of familiarity, a passionate recognition that these tunes endure as rich melodies, tough beats, and outrageous lyrics, not as some mummified works of great pop art. These lively covers also show that rock and roll sprang not just from African-American vocals, but from Southern American vocals, with their slippery cadences and backbeat smarts. In fact, the killer soundtrack to the movie Backbeat is a close parallel to this album. Lots of They Walk Among Us suggests a series of demented sermons on sin, sex, and salvation all at once. In fact, there's a literal dose of fire and brimstone preaching in Money Talks. And from the start, a big part of rock has been bashing the sacred and profane together with prurient interest in the results. Mud Boy and the Neutrons' medley of Land of a Thousand Dances and Shotgun goes on for too long, but that's all that's wrong here. They Walk Among Us is a roadhouse record with the funky feel you just don't hear much anymore.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge.
At the dark in all street, that is where we always meet, hiding in shadows where we don't belong, living in darkness to hide our.
Well, the East Coast is socked in from New England to Virginia, thanks to the blizzard of 96. To me, snow always brings something between minor inconvenience and calamity. But there's one good thing I can say about the snow. It's the inspiration for a few very good songs. My current favorite is called Snowbound, and it was written by Dave Frischberg, who recently performed it on Fresh Air. I'm going to play his recording of it from his CD Quality Time. Singing harmony is Rebecca Kilgore, who also recently performed on the show.
The north winds blow, it's 12 below. Streets like ice, ain't it nice to be snowbound, snowbound, no place to go. Hip deep in snow, we're all right, tucked in tight, 'cause we're snowbound. snowbound. The bad news is the weatherman says more bad weather. Snowbound. The good news is that here we are socked in together. The corn has popped. The clock has stopped. What a storm, what a sight. We'll keep warm through the night. Cause we're snowbound, snowbound. The fire, 9:30, let's retire. Cause we're snowbound, 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 me and you. Snowbound, 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 just we.
Dave Frischberg. Well, speaking of snowbound, a few people at Fresh Air managed to make it in today and get the show on the air. Special thanks to them. Producer Amy Sallet, associate producer Alan Tu, director Roberta Sherrock, and our engineer Chris Fraley, who's been here since 4 a.m. I'm Terry Gross, and in a minute I'll have to put those grotesque knee-high vinyl boots back on.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harmony Books, publisher of Deepak Chopra's Ageless Body, Timeless Mind, and now 20 Lessons for Living a Magical Life in the Way of the Wizard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.